Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming. I'm going to speak today about some research I'm doing looking at differences in soil carbon mass and soil energy budgets related to forest treatments in California. And I too would like to acknowledge my co-workers, Julie Bauer and Will Horwath. So this whole session is about carbon. Everyone's interested in carbon for a variety of reasons. And some of the previous speakers brought up the points about the influence that carbon has in the global cycle and how forests play that really important role, both because of the amount of carbon they fix in their biomass as well as the amount that they store in the ground. But we don't often talk about the energy that's associated with that biomass. We only really think about it when we want to make a fire or now with trying to harvest biomass energy to make fuel or to make energy. But everyone, when photosynthesis, you know, is at play, it's capturing energy, capturing energy, making it into a variety of biomolecules that have different energetic qualities and availabilities and usefulnesses in the system. And that energy is what's driving the system forward ultimately through the detritus cycle. And it kind of led me to the idea that is all soil carbon the same? You know, we think of a kilogram of soil carbon in one forest and a kilogram of soil carbon in another forest, but are those kilograms of carbon the same when you start to look at them in an energetic sense? So that's what I'll be talking about most importantly today. So in total, I'm going to show some data for some carbon estimates we made off of a couple of managed sites in California, and then some preliminary data off of some surface soils and using differential scanning calorimetry to look at the distribution of energy and stability in those soil samples. So we utilized the Garden of Eden study. Most of you in this room have heard about it multiple times throughout the years, but Bob Powers is not one of the nominal authors on this talk, but I wanted to acknowledge him for this study as well as others and kind of getting some of these long-term studies together, which have been incredibly valuable to us to understand how ecosystems function, forest ecosystems, as well as management and growing trees. But so basically the nuts and bolts of the study are it's looking at ponderosa pine monocultures or plantations in Northern California. It's the most common plantation species in Northern California and Southern Oregon. The basic ideas were there's two things they're trying to look at. Competition for light at early growth in the trees as well as water from understory shrubs and the overall site fertility. So there's a variety of treatments, a fertilizer, herbicide, a cross, and then an untreated control. And each treatment was replicated three times at each site. And then overall, the study crossed a gradient of site productivity as well as soil conditions. I utilized two of the sites. There were eight overall. I utilized the Whitmore site, which is here in the Southern Cascades. We're located on an extensive volcanic mud flow. As well as, and I also use the Feather Falls site, which is in the northern Sierra Nevada, but it's got a kind of a mix where it's got a tephra with a metadiorite underneath in the subsoil, and that will come up later when I talk about my deep to 2 meter samples, Rob. The sites are both taxonomically similar as haplohumults, but they're varying in the site productivity, with the Whitmore site kind of at the lower end of the mixed conifer zone or productivity. With the Feather Falls site being about as fine a site as you're going to find in California. And that shows out very clearly in the standing bull volume after 15 years, with Feather Falls being 2 to 5 times greater in bull volume after that short time. So we utilized a mass balance approach, and we were interested in deep, you know, trying to go deeper than just the top 50 centimeters. So we used the GeoProbe. That's an easier way to get at some of these samples as long as it's not too rocky. We used a GeoProbe and sampled 6 cores per treatment, so 2 in each of the replicated plots. We divided down to 2 meters. We segmented the cores into 10-centimeter segments and then dried them and weighed them for bulk density and numbers for bulk density. And then we took the surface samples and kept them as individuals, so 0 to 10 down to 50 centimeters. And then we composited the 3 10-centimeter increments together to bring down the number of samples for combustion analysis. So 0 to 10 down to here, and then 30-centimeter blocks down with depth. And here's a sample or an example of what the soil looks like down to 2 meters at those increments. And then processed them, combusted them, and then we want to get to this number, right? We all want some aerial estimate so we can start to compare things across treatments, across sites. When going into this whole approach, I want to emphasize the fact that what do we do this for? We do this so we can estimate things not in that plot. We try to understand what's happening in that plot so we can try to estimate something that's happening on the landscape. So I, with that in mind, I wanted to just show the site across all treatments. Generally speaking, these sites have about 3 to 4 kilograms per meter squared in the surface, you know, grading down to about 3/4 to 1 kilogram per meter squared at 50 centimeters and below, and still 0.5 kilogram down at depth at 2 meters. When we look at the two sites side by side, each one of these box plots is an N of 24. Just a quick reminder, a box plot is a nice way to show compare populations that might not have the same distribution. So it has a median value, not a mean, which is the central value in the distribution, an upper or lower and an upper quartile, which gives you 25%, the bottom 25 and the upper 25% of the population or of the data. And then the whiskers give you the lowest and highest observation that's within the expected distribution. And then these any dots outside represent something that's expected to be an outlier. So you can see that the Whitmore site has a pretty nice even distribution within each depth class, and the Feather Falls is a little more variable in the surface. These two sites were from one of the fertilized plots, and they just both tracked. They were both really high, and you know, that's, we all know that things are variable, and it's sometimes difficult to get really nice clean numbers, even you know, a sample size of 24. But an interesting thing that I brought up back with the kind of ties into Rob's thing and into mineralogy. So remember that the Whitmore site is on a volcanic mudflow, and the Feather Falls site has got about a 50 centimeter tephra cap over this metadiorite. So we saw this really interesting bulge in soil carbon down at depth that we didn't see in the silica rich site compared to the iron rich site. And then it plays out nicely when we start to look at the treatments and different depths in these different sites. So when we break out the treatments from that total population and we look at each treatment group with an N of 6, you can see that the treatments don't have the same effect at both sites. At Whitmore, at the poorer site, the fertilization seems to pump up the carbon in the soil carbon pool over the full profile. And I think it's just because there's, you know, enhanced litter inputs of both the conifers and those understory species. So you have a nice mix input of litter. The fertilization is increasing the turnover of the litter, and you're getting a bump in carbon in the fertilized plots. But at the higher quality side at Feather Falls, you've seen that the only treatment effect is that herbicide is actually reducing the carbon pool. And so it's kind of the inverse of the Whitmore site, where you're actually limiting the inputs of litter into that soil, so you're actually reducing the carbon pool. And we have some other data from some isotope work that kind of supports this, showing that litter quality really does have an effect on the soil carbon pool and turnover rates. So when we go one step more refined and we look just at the surface soil, some of those trends start to intensify. Fertilization seems to really have an effect, although the variability is so high to make any kind of statistical call on the data. But then the odd thing over here is that the fertilizer by herbicide treatment seems to has the lowest carbon pool, which I can't really explain other than, for some reason, at 30 centimeters, the carbon concentration just dove way off in almost all the treatments. And I don't have any way to explain that yet, but we'll be getting back to you on that one. And so to kind of tie in Rob's point, you know, if you just looked at the surface 50 centimeters at Whitmore, you would only get half of the story. But at Feather Falls, you get quite a bit. You know, like I said, that's kind of interesting thinking about those parent materials and how, you know, a much more even distribution of the total pool, if we consider 2 meters the total pool in this case, where Feather Falls has a much higher proportion of the carbon in the surface soils. So I kind of wanted to get through that part to get to the part that's really more interesting to me in this case, is using scanning calorimetry to try to create soil quality indexes that aren't based on fractionation, light fraction, all kind of site-specific respiration measurements, things like that. So basically, calorimetry, in short, is one of our oldest analytical methods that we have, and it's basically the controlled oxidation of a substance in a reactor. So, and there we can measure electrical energy that's either given off or taken on by that material as you heat it. So here's a typical what you would see from after I ran a soil sample. You know, as you heat a sample from ambient to 1100 degrees C, it gives off energy per unit of soil. We're going to be using the data I'll be showing you next. We used a binning approach where we took and broke up these this temperature regime into temperature bins. So thermofraction 1, 250 to 350 degrees C, 2 and 3. Other workers that have used this type of approach have proposed this and published papers showing that it modestly correlates to the three pools of the cycling model that we all use for turnover. So this first thermofraction basically is analogous to the labile annual turnover or to decadal turnover. The second thermofraction is the stabile fraction that's more decade to century. And then this third pool is the chemically recalcitrant or black carbon or char type of pool. Others have shown this as a very distinct pool. Another way to identify black carbon in soil is through this approach, and it comes out very cleanly around about 550 to 600 degrees pretty regularly. So basically, like I said, we want to bin this data and start looking at saying, does soil carbon have different qualities? Is a gram of soil carbon here the same as a gram of soil carbon over there? So when we look at the Whitmore site, it's kind of ironic that it was so nice and well-behaved for the total carbon data, but the thermal data seems to be a little bit more messy. It's not as distinct. So here we have an N of 3 for three treatments, the control, the fertilizer, and the herbicide, and the three fractions, so 250 to 350 degrees, 350 to 500, and 500 to 650. And, you know, once again, the data is a little bit noisy, so it's hard to make any kind of statistical statement on what's actually happening here, but funny to see that the fertilizer and herbicide plots or soils seem to have the same amount of energy stored in them. And the control seems to have less. And like I said, I this might be a little misleading because the variability on the measurements is a little bit wide. But when you move to the Featherfall site, the site that had more variability in the carbon contents, the thermal variability is very low, right? And here the treatments show up very clearly with the fertilizer treatment having quite a bit of energy. These are all in joules per gram, and in the next slide I'll ramp it up to a meter square estimate just to get it all in line. But you can see here that the fertilizer seems to have quite a bit of energy in it stored, whatever this is, quite a bit is relative. And that the fertilizer, or the herbicide treatment, pardon me, seems to be getting rid of having less energy associated with it because of the treatment. So then when you kind of step back and look at it on a whole, this figure, now we've scaled it up to meter squared and we've got kilojoules, so we've aggregated the measurements up to a through bulk density and through dimensional analysis. And we look at the pool of carbon in that, the average pool of carbon in that slice of soil. And here's the energy content that you see in those samples. And so in a case where we have similar energy measured, we don't have the same amount of carbon, right? And in this case, you know, the one that has the most energy doesn't have the most amount of carbon in it. So I would argue that all soil carbon is not the same. And this is just a handful. I've got hundreds of samples that we're working through right now to try to show this effect, not just in this isolated situation, but in different forests with, you know, similar treatments and different litter inputs, and trying to break it down that way and say how much energy is going in or what's the quality of the inputs, and can we use this as a way to estimate a treatment effect, not just in mass but in some sort of fraction base, where in these lower energy fractions, if those are truly the labile fraction, if you can see where carbon is being accumulated or depleted in that related to a treatment, that might be a really interesting way for us to kind of address some of the treatment effects that we can't really get just on a mass base. So basic summary, treatments affect carbon stock, but it's hard to statistically quantify because of variability and by site. Paramaterial seems to have a major influence, at this site at least. I think that the treatments have altered the distribution of carbon in these different pools. More research is needed, and there will be a paper upcoming so you guys can find out more about it when I put it all together. And I'll ask any questions or answer any questions you might have.
We'll hold the questions.